and welcome to the Law Down Under podcast with Barrister Chris Patterson. We will give you insights into the law in New Zealand and Australia, its application and the law's future. Each episode features a new guest who will inspire your interest in the law and give you a greater understanding of the legal issues that help shape our justice system here down under. We thank you for tuning in and enjoy the podcast. In this episode of the podcast, I'm joined by the Honourable Duncan Webb. He is the Labour MP for Christchurch Central. Duncan Webb currently has in the parliamentary schedule a members' bill seeking to reform and modernise certain aspects of insurance contract law. We discuss his pathway and his entry into the law. He shares with us some of his experience as an insurance lawyer before becoming a Member of Parliament. We discuss most of the key aspects of the Insurance Contracts Bill. This is a fascinating episode for anyone interested in some of the problems and challenges that arise with insurance contracts and the possible future modernisation and reform of insurance law in New Zealand. I'm sure that you'll enjoy this episode with the Honourable Dr. Duncan Webb. Hi, Chris Patterson from the Law Down Under podcast. Can I have just a couple of moments of your time? I want to tell you about a very important legal resource. In fact, it is my favourite legal resource. I'm talking about NZLII. Jump on your browser, type in nzlii.org. You'll be taken to the New Zealand Legal Information Institute, where you're going to find free, yes, free, access to legal information in New Zealand. NZLII is part of AUSLII, which is the Australian Legal Information Institute. NZLII is a joint project of the University of Otago's Faculty of Law, the University of Canterbury, AUSLII, and with assistance from Victoria University of Wellington's Law School. So what does it contain? Well, it contains a lot of legal information, and you'll be amazed. It contains legislative material going back to 1841. The Historical Acts and Bills database is extremely popular, not only with legal types, but with social history researchers. So if you want to step back in time and have a look at New Zealand laws from the 19th and 20th centuries, you don't need a TARDIS. Most of them are there and waiting for you to connect with them. Also on NZLII, you'll find the New Zealand Government Gazettes. They're the most popular database, attracting over 5.3 million users in 2023 alone. NZLII have got 70 years of New Zealand Government Gazettes scanned. They just need a bit more funding, and they're going to try and go all the way back to 1840. NZLII has over 410,000 case documents on it. So if you're a lawyer and you just want to see how many times you've appeared in the law reports, just jump on NZLII. It'll find every single one. There's 563,000 documents in total. That's over 500,000 legal documents. The recent database additions include the Book of Awards, a database of all royal reports of royal commissions or reports of royal commissions. And if you really want to check out what life was like in 1912, check out the cost of living. They've also produced a guide to Justice of the Peace traffic courts, which will also join their ACC guide on their communities platform. And it was created with donations. NZLII lives and dies by donations and volunteers. Now, they get around 34 million users a year. Now, they're not tracking users, so you don't need to use a VPN or anything like that to hide your tracks. Privacy is very important to NZLII. They don't allow any of the search engines in there like Google, etc. Because it's free, it's basic. Some have called it ugly. I don't know why. I think it's fantastic. Now, the resources have gone into the content, but not their aesthetics. Their funding comes from Vice-Chancellors of the Law School of Otago, the New Zealand Council for Law Reporting, Auckland Council, and donations. Now, the legal profession provides some donations, but they need more, okay? These things just don't run on themselves. There's so many things that Judy and a team of volunteers at NZLII want to do if they can get more funding. They want to add some older High Court and Court of Appeal decisions, some new easy-to-use guides. They're looking for volunteers if you don't want to make a donation but you want to volunteer some time to add some new databases. They've got a very long list. Please get onto the NZLII website and click on Contribute, and you'll see a link for Contribute and $3 signs. NZLEE is a great resource. It provides free access to our laws. Please support it. Thank you. On today's episode of the Law Down Under podcast, we are joined by former lawyer and current Member of Parliament, Dr. Duncan Webb. Duncan joined the New Zealand Labour Party back in 1999. He's served as an MP for Christchurch Central since 2017. He's a former insurance lawyer. He's a professor of law. Duncan has also worked for the Public Interest Project, which seeks to free innocent people from jail, and the Howard League, an organisation that advocates for prison reform. Duncan serves as a deputy shadow leader of the House. He's a member of the Judicial Committee, or the Justice Committee, and the co-chairperson of the New Zealand, Middle East and African Interparliamentary Friendship Group. He is also the party spokesman for Christchurch Issues, Justice, Earthquake Commission and Regulation. Today we're going to be talking to Duncan about Duncan's bill, the Insurance Contracts Bill, which has been taken out of the cake tin as being a member's allotted bill, which was drawn from the member's ballot biscuit tin in Parliament. Duncan's bill aims to modernise insurance laws in New Zealand, making insurance contracts fairer and clearer for consumers. We're going to talk to Duncan about the bill, how it rectifies several issues in our existing insurance law framework and bring much needed reform to the industry. Duncan, good morning. Welcome. Oh, actually, we've just gone midday. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon. No, good to be here. After a few technical issues, we're here. We're good to go. And really excited to talk about this insurance contract stuff.
Yeah, look, I got you a little bit confused there where I say, Duncan, take it off mute. God, I tell you what, since the pandemic, we've all had to customize to remote meetings, Zoom, CMS Teams and that. And boy, there's been some funny things happen, but I'm glad.
Well, I just thought you were trying to throw me off for this piercing interview that we're having, right?
Exactly. Look, it's great to have you join. Let's just, before we get into the topic of insurance law and insurance contracts, and I'm gonna challenge you about that, whether it is actually an area of the law. Okay, we're gonna get there. Okay. And see if we get some debate going with that. Let's just talk a little bit about your background. And look, your family originally immigrated from the UK. You landed in Christchurch. What was your pathway to the law? Were there lawyers in your family?
No, not at all. My pathway, it wasn't so much a pathway as sort of stumbling through undergrowth. I left school in a rush. Didn't quite fit. I left very early on in what was then the seventh form because it really wasn't for me. And then got on my bike and cycled across town in Christchurch and asked at the registry desk whether I could still enrol. And it turns out I could. I then got the, enrolment book, whatever it was, and thumbed through and ran my finger down it and picked a few random subjects, and law was one of them.
So this is the ripe old age of 17, 18, presumably.
I was 17 at the time. I was not yet 18. As I think I just mentioned off air, so to speak, I scraped through my first year paper and thought, oh, that's interesting, and got into the second year courses and it was one of those things where I wasn't driven to be a lawyer, but I was more driven by curiosity of what was a quite unusual kind of area of academic inquiry. It's a strange kind of social science, the law, and it drew me in.
Right, and look, I understand that your undergraduate degree, you weren't exactly the A-plus student. In fact, I hear through the grapevine that you may have even failed contract law your first time round.
Yeah, it is hard to smash an exam when you're asleep.
Yes. Right, so you slept through your contract law exam. Okay. I take it that wasn't deliberate. There was an oversight and an omission.
There was very much an oversight and omission. There was what we'd now call a scheduling error on my part. And by the time I woke up, and I lived in Brighton across the other side of town from the university, it was a 40-minute summer bike. I wasn't going to get there in any state to finish the exam in a half an hour, so I had to throw that away. But I must say, other than the lame law lecturer jokes, the lectures were great a second time around.
and of course, that's probably permanently emblazoned on your mind, the law of contract.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. And maybe that's why we're here today, because, you know, that framework that it was Professor John Burroughs back in the day, who's a bit of a doyen of the law. Yeah. You know, he was a great lecturer, actually. So and insurance law, as you said, it's a subset of contract in many ways.
Yeah, well, we'll come back to that in a moment. Now, just one of the things, Duncan, is that you obviously found that you liked studying because you went on and got a doctorate. So tell us about what sort of led to that outcome.
Well, I've actually got a Doctor of Laws rather than a PhD, and which is a funny little nook and cranny of academia where you submit work. It's the cheapest way to get a doctorate, right? Okay. You submit stuff that you've written already. So, I got it in professional ethics where I wrote a book and I helped the Law Society write their professional rules. And I wrote a number of articles and kind of submitted it as a body of work. So through the course of 10 or 15 years in academia, if you haven't written enough good material to show that you have mastered an area and have got something to say, you're probably in the wrong job. But yeah, that's the doctorate I got. It was really good to do, and I must admit I'm proud to have done a lot of that work in professional ethics as well.
Fantastic. I actually happen to have with me, as it so happens, not your first edition, but the second edition, which I found the second much greater improvement on the first. I mean, the first was outstanding, but the second edition is I'd never have this book anywhere further than a couple of meters from me all the time.
The people who aren't actually seeing anything but are only listening, it must be to hold up his screen because it's absolutely untouched. It's a pristine version and it looks like it's never been opened. Either you're very ethical or you just don't give a...
Well, actually, you know, this was one of the things that I was super disappointed when your assistant said, "Oh, no, Duncan's going to join in the podcast from Christchurch." And I said, "What? But I want him to autograph my book." She said, "Oh, next time you're down, I'm sure he'll do it."
We can arrange something. There's always an oddball out there who wants me to sign something once every 3 or 4 months.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No. Look, it's maybe that'll be another podcast at another time. But let's move into the area of insurance contracts. I think I've already foreshadowed this, and that is there such an area of law? And I know that there are literally hundreds of insurance lawyers out there. They say they're insurance lawyers, and your CV says that you're an insurance lawyer. Is there actually an area of actual insurance law, or is it just a subset of contract law?
Oh, that's a bit formalistic. Yeah, the question's presupposing that there are divisions in the law, you know. Yeah. And obviously, there are lawyers who specialise in working for, say, insurance companies, or when I was a lawyer, I specialised in working essentially against insurance companies. And you certainly learn a set of skills that are really relevant. In terms of the discipline itself, well, in those lawyers, I became an expert in building law. So I was doing a whole lot of homeowner stuff. I guess you get this kind of conceptual boundaries, which can come in two shapes. It's like either there's a practical area, transport law, building law, whatever it might be, or there's a kind of conceptual area, contract law, tort law, constitutional law. Insurance law is probably a practical demarcation. It tells you about the industry you're working in rather than the conceptual tools you're working with. And of course, if you're an insurance lawyer, quite often you're dealing with a lot of tort law, a lot of contract law, and a whole other areas of the law as well. But, you know, I take your point. If you're talking about the way insurance works, at the end of the day, you're dealing with a contract. And I think sometimes that's one of the most – I used to give a whole lot of talks to homeowners. Yeah. And probably the biggest tool I ever gave them was to tell them that, look, you're dealing with a contract. Go and read the contract.
Yep.
Then have your argument.
Now, I mean, look, and to be fair, if we think about and we'll just say insurance law or insurance contract law, there is a difference between marine insurance principles and non-marine insurance. And your bill is very much focused on the non-marine side, because the marine side has its own archaic set of rules that have come about over literally hundreds of years, mainly from the United Kingdom. We've adopted a few of those. But what I understand your bill to be very much focused on is the non-marine side, if I got that right?
Yeah, you know, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I'm not an expert in marine, although I have dabbled. But obviously, it's really important to have international consistency there. Mm. And so this is really looking at domestic insurance, fire in general, life, that sort of thing. So, and it has the bill overall, and I'm imagining you've had a glance through it. It's got a real consumer focus.
Yeah, it does draw, and we will do. We'll get deeper into it at the moment in a moment. It does draw that distinction between consumer and non-consumer insurance. But before we do, why don't we just talk about what an actual insurance contract is? And maybe let's use a little example. So we go to the Riccarton race course for the races, and we've got the main event, and a horse is racing along. Now there are people there who are waging, they're having bets on who's going to win, and of course that's an event, and the punter pays the money to the bookie, and the bookie goes, okay, I'll accept this on the basis that I don't think that horse is going to win, but if it does win, I'll pay you some money. What's the difference between that scenario and me saying to my insurance broker, I've got a racehorse and I want to insure it so it doesn't die during the third race at Riccarton?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the element there, and you're making me dive back into my law lecturing days, is the kind of interest that you've got.
Yeah.
If all you've got is a speculative interest that it's a windfall if the horse wins, and you just lose your stake if it loses, we know what it is. It's gambling, right?
Yeah.
Having said that, you know, as soon as you start scratching a bit further and deeper, it becomes a little less clear. So if I or if I'm growing wheat and I want to insure against the price of it falling, that looks like I've got an interest. Also looks a bit like a futures contract and a derivative, which is a financial instrument, but it also looks a little bit like I'm gambling about the weather as well. So who knows, right?
Mm. So look, I'll share with you, and maybe we can build on this. It might have been a dinner in Sydney that I had with a couple of underwriters, and we may have actually drunk quite a lot of red wine. In fact, I know for a fact that I paid for it all, so there was actually quite a lot that they drank. But one of them said to me, and he was a very experienced underwriter with one of the large listed Australian underwriters. No longer there, but he did say, look, I'm paid this amount of money, and it was almost eye-watering. I thought, I've obviously made the wrong error of becoming a lawyer, should have become an underwriter. But he said, I'm paid a lot of money to be a professional gambler. And that, I guess that's what got me thinking about the insurance contract, the nature of it. And if we just say, most people who own a home will have their house insured, and you'll know a lot about this because of your background. You know, there's a gamble going on there that the insurance underwriter is saying, well, I don't think you're going to suffer a loss, and you as the homeowner.
There's not really, right?
Well, there's not really. You're right. Yeah, yeah. No, what do you think?
Well, the gambling stopped. I forget the exact date, but wasn't it in the late 1700s when life insurance was invented by the Scottish Widows Society? Yeah, you're familiar with the story, right?
Yeah, I do, yeah. But please tell.
Someone went through the deaths in Scotland and worked out what the rough actuarial probability was of dying. Gambling stopped on that day because with a high degree of certainty, they knew that if they had a pool of people that was large enough, that were all telling the truth, roughly, about their age, they could take money off them and profit from it. Actually, it was a not-for-profit, which is a lovely thing as well, and pay life insurance policies. And it's the same with house and home insurance, and fire in general, and all kinds of insurance. And we know now, this is one of the challenges for insurance now, because the information is so good that, in fact, where the risks are too high, it no longer becomes possible to pool it in the way that it previously has, both in respect of life and in respect of home.
Yeah, and I guess with advancements to medical science and technology, those that are insuring, for example, for life or income protection, have now got an unprecedented level of data that they're able to work out statistically. You know, Duncan Webb is, you know, X age, he doesn't smoke, etc. Just literally when you're likely to die.
And of course, at the moment, I think we've still got a moratorium on it, but a pinprick DNA test would give you a whole lot more information, which would raise real questions about the meaningfulness of life and health insurance.
Yeah, and the privacy issues that go with it as well.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there's a lot going on. I have got an email from a professor at the Auckland University Medical School to get back to me with this bill on those medical ethics issues in life insurance. Yep. I'm not sure that's a particular knot I want to start untying.
Okay. All right. Let's dive into this bill. Now, by way of background, you know, most pieces of legislation are there to, resolve some mischief or try and make, the world a better place. What's the background for this bill? Like, why is it needed?
Yeah, look, I guess there's a number of ways I could answer that. The kind of Law Commission way would say that there was the prudent insurer test around misrepresentations was creating some real injustices in the way that insurers could treat policyholders if they made a mistake when they took their insurance out. I guess that, and this is the funny thing about getting into politics, that that's kind of the legal explanation. The other explanation is to stand back and say, insurance has transformed. It's no longer a contract between roughly equal parties. It's a standard form contract which the buyers never read, and the sellers spend enormous amounts of time on and energy framing in such a way as to make their businesses work. So to kind of put the finger on the scales for the consumer, we need to have a really carefully drafted set of rules. And that's why there's more than just a fix to the prudent insurer test in here.
Okay, yeah. So it's trying to strike the right and fair balance. Is that a good way of putting it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
And at the same time, making sure, because I was briefly, for a brief flicker of time, Minister of Commerce and Consumer Affairs. Whilst I had a consumer focus when I was there, it's always important to make sure the market still works. And so it's also about making sure that in terms of the machinery of how the insurance market works, and this is a large part of it, it's still effective and efficient and doesn't impose, undue costs, which will just drive costs up for everyone.
Well, also, it's not just a costs issue, Duncan. Would you agree with me that it's actually having insurance available full stop? Because if things become too difficult for insurers, they'll just withdraw, maybe not completely, but certain products. And those products are necessary to help, whether it's the wheels of commerce or just people feel safe that they are covered.
Yes, that's right. I think if we look at New Zealand, and I think this is a really important thing to do, insurance plays a different part in our economy than some other. Our health insurance sector isn't as thoroughgoing as, say, in the United States because of our health system. Our home insurance system is supported by our EQC natural hazards framework. And I think we need to see it as an entire ecosystem. But you're right, there are some risks. But we need to be cautious that foot stamping by large businesses doesn't lead to underprotection of consumers, right?
Yeah, correct. Absolutely. Now, I noticed that the United Kingdom addressed this whole issue of the duty of disclosure, particularly for consumers. Because it seems that that's a large part of this bill. It's the utmost good faith. You mentioned power imbalance, and I took it from what you were saying, Duncan, that, well, the insurers have got a lot of power. You know, they've got all the resources to draft these complicated contracts, and they can pretty much present them as a fait accompli. But there's a flip side on the disclosure side. A lot of the case law, which talks about the utmost good faith, is that the insured, the person who's wanting insurance, they have a lot of power as well, because they're the ones who come to the table or the relationship knowing what they know. The insurer doesn't necessarily know what they know, and hence That's why there is this duty of utmost good faith. And that is the bill attempting to strike a fairer balance so that the effect or the consequences of, you know, an individual failing to disclose something that they didn't appreciate the time that they should disclose results in their insurance, which they've been paying premiums for, suddenly being cancelled?
Well, you know, I think you'll probably remember the name of the case, but it escapes me right at the moment. You know, this duty of disclosure essentially came out of maritime insurance, right? And it came out of the basis that mariners and ship owners and merchants knew exactly what was going on. Mm. And they could insure cargoes whilst they were traveling, you know, in faraway places. And of course, they're going to know what the risks to the cargo are. They're going to know whether it's lost or not lost. They're going to know whether it's going through this strait or that strait or through pirate-infested waters and so on. So yes, in the 1760s, before rapid communications, the knowledge imbalance favoured the policyholder, favoured the insured. But it's just not really accurate to say that that's the case anymore. So if we look at, you know, like you say, you take just about any area of insurance, health insurance. If you are asked a series of questions about your age, your smoking habits, your gender, your ethnicity, and so on, the amount of knowledge that the insurer then has about your health prospects is far greater than you have yourself. And of course, the insurer has the ability to know this across populations, which is an additional factor in assessing it. So I think we need to be a bit cautious about saying there's this kind of imbalance. And of course, the real reforms here are around consumers who aren't sophisticated, and insurers have no longer do insurers just say, well, what's the risk? They ask a series of detailed questions. To assess that risk. And that's why I think the industry's changed radically since, you know, these rules were put into place, not only in the last hundreds of years, but even in the last tens and twenties of years. You've got to remember, a lot of this is done online now. Yep, so a lot of insureds will tick boxes that the insurers have given to them on a basically a yes-no basis. So the whole kind of the insured has all of this knowledge and information that the insurer doesn't is not really as accurate as it used to be.
Yeah. I was told quite what I thought was a sad story by a colleague. I mean, obviously the names have to be completely anonymized. But we'll just say that, you know, Jane, mother of three, has been paying income protection insurance for, you know, over a decade. When took the policy out in any renewals, you know, explained, gave all the disclosures about her health, et cetera, but had failed to disclose that as a teenager, went through a period of depression, you know, a bit of bulimia, I think, maybe even anorexia, and then suffered an accident, not 30 years, let's say 20 years later, and the insurer looked to avoid paying income protection because of a failure to disclose something that just did not cross her mind, that was years before the policy was taken out and was unrelated to the accident at all, because of going, well, you should have told us that.
Yeah, and that's exactly where this bill would almost suit. Well, it would make a real and significant difference there, as long as we could say that Jane acted reasonably at the time, wasn't negligent, wasn't fraudulent, she would get a remedy. It might not be the whole lot. There might be some adjustments in light of the fact that the insurer might have changed the premium, say, but she would have been covered.
Okay. And this, I guess, this is the point of striking the balance in a way that's not only fair, but it's also just reflects the practical realities that most people filling out insurance declarations don't know every situation that the insurer may deem to be material and what it is that the insurer is looking for, and also the unfairness of failing to disclose something that actually ultimately wouldn't have altered the risk to the insurer, they would have insured anyway.
Yeah, and I think, look, that the real crux of it is that point that that it is fanciful to think that a consumer would know what a professional underwriter thinks is relevant to a risk, you know, and whether that be, you know, depression in your early teens or, you know, a toothache, whatever it might be, or recurrent headaches is another one, right? Yeah. Things like that. Now, they may well be relevant. I'm not a medical expert, but of course a consumer shouldn't be expected to second guess those things. And increasingly, the fact is that insurers ask a series of questions, and of course they throw in a catch-all anything else. Now, if they've asked 40 questions across 8 pages, you're pretty much exhausted. You can't be expected to think, yes, there's something else I should let you know about.
Yeah. Now, not that I give legal advice on this podcast, but it would seem to make sense to me that if an insurer was asking sort of some, you know, very generalized questions, that maybe a response to consider would be to say, well, I'd have to think about that and come back to you. Now, if the insurer carries on and insures you, then that might help.
Or you could just be much more open and frank and say, well, is there anything else you want to know?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, and of course, the great thing about this bill, and we will need to talk about, the progress that you're hoping and others will be hoping it'll make, is that it's going to hopefully avoid disputes, because disputes are pretty corrosive and have a terrible effect on people. And you'll have seen that firsthand in Christchurch back when you were working as a lawyer.
Oh, no. And it was always frustrating to sit down with a, you know, person whose house had been broken in the earthquake, and you're 5 years on, and you've given them all their advice about their claim, and then talk to them about the prospect of litigation and what it really meant, and how essentially litigating was losing by definition, right? And, you know, to finish that process and notionally win, but still be $200,000 or $300,000 worse off than you should have been, you know, those kind of disputes are hopeless. And that's a different and separate problem. And, of course, there are dispute resolution mechanisms which go a long way to sorting that out, at least in some circumstances. But the problem isn't solved yet.
Yeah, and, of course, I mean, for a family that it's gone through a natural disaster like an earthquake, to then be pushed into a human-made disaster, which is dispute resolution, it could be absolutely a double tragedy for them.
And I saw that happen. Through the Christchurch and Canterbury earthquakes, I saw marriages break up, and I saw people die whilst they were waiting for their claim, and all kinds of other things. I mean, we have, you know, and I'm politically speaking, you know, the Claims Resolution Service, which was built on the Residential Advisory Service that National put in place, that's done a good job. I think, you know, that much more collaborative approach has made a huge difference. But that requires everyone in the room to take a collaborative approach: homeowner, lawyers, experts, EQC, and insurers. And that's quite a magical thing.
Yeah, I mean, if you can get everyone in that ecosystem that you're talking about working together towards going, look, there's an event that's occurred, there's a claim, let's get it out the other end as efficiently and as effectively, there is a massive benefit to all involved. There's few people that would say that delaying resolution is beneficial to anyone.
You know, that's right. There's a very few people who benefit from delay.
Yeah, and I did, just on the dispute resolution, sorry, this is the litigator and dispute resolution lawyer of me coming out, I did notice that your bill is going to prohibit arbitration clauses, but not prevent the parties agreeing to go to arbitration after the event. So it's just making sure that before the event, you don't have an insured who goes, oh, I didn't realise that, now I'm going to be stuck in a private process that could be even more expensive.
Yeah, in the litigator, and you're clearly a bit more aware than some about how arbitration can work. It can be very not only expensive, but less procedurally fair. You know, it can be driven quite quickly in a way that a consumer would find quite alarming. But that's actually the law already in terms of consumer disputes in the Arbitration Act, and it's just putting it there to make sure it's absolutely and abundantly clear that you can't, an insurer can't throw an arbitration clause in, which no one would ever read, and then say, well, you can't sue me in court. You know, I'm appointing an arbitrator, you've got 7 days to object, and off you go, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I look 100%. I mean, arbitration is a fantastic mechanism for certain things, but not necessarily for an insurance claim in all circumstances. The other, just on this topic of moving things along promptly, would it be fair to say that the bill isn't just addressing sort of that inequality or imbalance to do around the duty of utmost good faith, but it's actually tidying up a number of areas to get insurance contracts working more efficiently, including having insurance companies responding to claims in a more timely manner?
Yeah, I mean, full disclosure, this is a bill that was kicked off. The Law Commission did work on it a long time ago. Mm. Chris Farfoy, when he was minister, commissioned the work. David Clark saw it through. And when I saw it, it was in a pretty good shape as minister, but I didn't get a chance to introduce it into the House. And so when I got fired by the good people of New Zealand as the Labour government, I thought that I wanted to make sure this kept moving, so I put it in as a members' bill. So it is actually a consolidation and reform of large parts of insurance law, which was pretty old, dusty, and disjointed, including, as you say, taking the duty of good faith, which is there already. And, you know, the detractors say, well, you're not changing anything. I actually think it's really important to have it in legislation and point out that, you know, the duty to assess a claim, to decide a claim, because quite often insurers that I dealt with would say, well, we're still thinking about it. If you push us, we don't have enough information. And then actually settle a claim in a timely manner is really, really important.
Yeah, no, look, absolutely. I completely agree. Another area that the bill does tend to bring into, and I guess this is just trying to, modernise, but deal with relationships that have gone wrong in the past. There are examples, and the one that I'm thinking of is the relationship between an insured and a broker when they're paying premiums and assuming that those premiums are actually going to the underwriter. And the case that springs to mind is the Herbert Insurance case, where there was millions of dollars of premiums paid to Herbert Insurance, which never went to the underwriter, and those people weren't insured.
Yeah. Well, we can't have that.
No, we can't have that.
And one of the challenges, again, putting yourself in the shoes of the consumer, if you pay your broker, you for all intents and purposes, you think you've paid your insurer. And even though at law, and this is a whole bit of agency law in here, right? You're probably well familiar with it. Even though at law, the broker may well be the agent for the insured, not the insurer, that's not what it feels and looks like. To the consumer who sees, often insurance branding at the office of the broker and so on, and they act like they're an insurer. So payment to the broker's got to be seen as payment to the insurer, right?
Yeah, look, absolutely. And of course, most lawyers who have dabbled or work in insurance will have had conversations with clients where the client starts talking about their insurer. And you need to point out, well, actually, no, they're not your insurer. They're the broker, okay? And they're the one who take a commission and clip the ticket on the way through, but they're not insuring you. They're not the one.
Yeah.
So, and I think understanding that relationship for people improves things, but I see your bill tightens that up to make sure that there are duties.
I mean,
there.
The other funny thing that goes on there is that brokers appear to make quite a lot of money out of holding on to those premiums for a while before they pass them on to the insurer. Mm. Now, that's a fight we could have got into, but I think they're all grown up, so they can sort that out for themselves.
Yeah, well, I guess in this high interest environment we're in, if they're holding on to enough money for long enough, there's probably a bit of return there for them.
And those trust accounts are many millions of dollars some of the time.
Yeah, look, absolutely. And look, the bill does tidy up, I guess, also some certain areas where it's not often as a lawyer that you have to dive down into the Law Reform Act of 1937 and look at the issue of third-party claims against insurers. But of course, this came up in the it's come up in a number of areas, but it came up a lot after the GFC with our second tier finance company collapses. A lot of the directors had D&O directors and officers cover, but it was difficult for creditors to access it without sort of engaging in sort of a convoluted, archaic pathway of the law. And some of these cases went all the way to the Supreme Court on this. But your bill does start tending to make it clear that, you know, third parties can bring claims.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I must say, when those cases started going on to the Supreme Court and discussing what kind of information parties were entitled to about the extent of insurance and so on, it did get, like you say, pretty complicated. And they were fine points, but they were fine points that were worth many, many millions of dollars. And look, when people do have insurance like directors and officers insurance, we know that it should survive insolvency, but you've got to have the tools to do it. And so what this essentially tries to do is tidy it up to make sure it's clear that a claimant against an insolvent insured party can essentially have a good look through to go and pursue that insurer for any insured losses that they've suffered.
Yep. And at a more kind of consumer level, take life insurance, for example. Very sad situation that I had a few years ago. I had a student come in and see me and told me a terrible, horrific story about her mother being killed in the UK, murdered, and just the hoops that she had to jump through to be able to access her mother's life insurance. Your bill provides a mechanism that is going to hopefully make that less of a drama, particularly at a time which is really upsetting for people when they're having to make claims on life insurance.
Yeah, you're talking about the interest.
Yes. Yeah, the interest register.
Because obviously what the trigger for payment in any insurance claim is the occurrence of an event, right? Yeah. And it's always perplexed me as to why life insurance took so long to pay. And insurers, look, I can understand that they want to make sure they're paying the right person and, you know, probate is properly administered and so on. But at the end of the day, the entitlement should run from the date of death. Now, there's going to be some administrative details around there, but shortly thereafter, in this bill, interest will run, which will give an incentive. And it'll probably run at a little bit more than the holding costs for the insurance company, which will encourage them to help along that administration along.
Yeah, because, I mean, to a certain extent, I'm taking it that those provisions, particularly around life insurance, to reduce some of the friction that consumers experience, you know, at a time of loss, you know, they lost a loved one, et cetera, you know, we're not going to be able to get around necessarily, you know, you've got to apply for probate and all of those processes, but at least find those friction points and smooth them over so that those that are entitled to the insurance payer actually get it in a timely way, without having to, you know, wait a long time or engage the services of lawyers or having to deal too much with those that are administering the estates.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And I guess that's one of the jobs of law. It's kind of it's achieving those things by a nudge, right? It's not coming down and saying, here's exactly how you're going to do it, but it's creating a set of incentives which makes it worthwhile to, like you say, oil the wheels and remove the friction.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about the bill and where from here. Now, it's been drawn as a member's bill. What are the next stages?
Well, the next formal stage will be the first reading. So that's the, you know, first time it appears in Parliament, and I'll stand up and speak to it and say what it excellent bill it is and how I hope everyone will vote in favour of it. In fact, of course, the real next stage is happening right now and, in fact, in real time, because I consider this to be an important part of my lobbying process. Because I have got to get, you know, the my side of the House in the minority, so I have to get some support at least from the other side of the House, from National, New Zealand First, or ACT. And I've reached out to everyone, had some conversations, I haven't got any commitments. The challenge is that the way the rules of Parliament work, you can't have two bills the same in Parliament at any one time.
Right.
So the Minister of Commerce was, you know, had this on his jobs list, but it wasn't clear to me, and he couldn't tell me when he was going to get around to it, so I put it in. There's also a rule that says if this bill gets defeated, you can't introduce a substantially similar bill within a year. So, you know, it's either this bill or we wait a bit longer. Now, of course, if it gets past first reading, we go off to select committee and it will get knocked around, and I'm sure it will be changed in ways possibly that I wouldn't approve of, but I've kind of got to give up ownership and be its advocate and give it to the ownership of Parliament, who will make the changes that it sees fit to it.
Well, I guess in most negotiations, you've got to have a starting point and be open to a bit of compromise. And I guess if it gets through to select committee stage, that's when the negotiation compromise. In terms of cross-party support, I mean, are you getting any sense that there's any stern opposition to the bill? I mean, there doesn't appear to be anything that jumps out to say, oh, you know, if you were slightly right of centre, you'd be really against these provisions, because so many of them make, you know, common sense.
Well, I agree, Chris.
Yeah.
Look, there are a number of provisions in that bill which had to make a choice that was either pro-insurer or pro-consumer. A really good example of that would be bringing the bill into the unfair contract terms in the Fair Trading Act, so bringing insurance contracts into the Fair Trading Act framework. At the moment, they've got a total free pass.
Yeah.
Now, to me, that is frankly outrageous. The idea that of all the industries in New Zealand, insurers are the only ones who aren't in the unfair contract term provisions makes no sense. There was a decision to be made about if they come in, do we bring them in for the entire contract other than the what's insured, or do you have some wider carve-outs? Now, I've gone for the broader approach. Mm. The insurance industry clearly would have liked a more restrictive approach. And I have absolutely no doubt that the minister is having conversations with the insurance industry, and they will be talking about what they would like to see, whether this bill goes forward or whether it gets, you know, voted down at the first reading.
Wouldn't there be an advantage, though, to the industry to have a bit of standardisation? And we'll just go back to the issue of, you know, utmost good faith and disclosure, because I suspect that the policy that one insurer might apply to, okay, well, you didn't tell us about that, but look, we'll still cover you, might be different to another insurer down the road who might take a harder approach. And having some standardisation, one set of rules for everyone, wouldn't there be a benefit in that?
I can see your point, but at the end of the day, I think insurers like to have the choice, because you know, and from your experience, it appears that insurers often will come across a non-disclosure. They'll recognise that it would be disproportionate to avoid the policy entirely, and they'll have a conversation.
Yeah.
You know, now sometimes that conversation will be, well, we'll pay you half, right? Rather than under this legislation where they would be told exactly what they have to do. Or in the ones I've seen is where you see someone who's had a non-disclosure and the insurer just needs another reason to decline a claim because they don't like it anyway. And they've got a sure thing.
Yeah.
So they rely on the sure thing non-disclosure rather than running a, you know, no damage argument or not an accident or whatever it might be.
Mm.
So there's a whole lot of reasons insurers like to have a little bit of fogginess around this area of the law.
Yeah, and of course, that, I mean, I've mentioned between insurers, but I mean, even within one insurer, I mean, you can have inconsistencies, and I might get hunted down by the claims managers on Queen Street about this, but you can have inconsistencies between claims handling, between claims managers, and that can be unfair. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and look, that's right, but that's good internal processes as well. Right. But you're right. A good, clear legal framework is a huge assistance if you're going to have good, clear internal processes.
Okay. And look, is there scheduling in terms of when the first reading of this bill is going to occur? Has that been announced?
It does depend on parliamentary business. Yep. It's not going to be immediately, but there's essentially a queuing system. And at the moment, I'm at the bottom of the queue because I was one of the most recently drawn bills. So it'll be a few weeks away yet, but it won't be many, many months. We'll see it soon. Okay. I should sit down and make an estimate and let you know.
Yeah, okay. All right. Well, I guess a bit more time is probably a good thing in terms of being able to get some cross-party support and some commitment towards it. I mean, in many respects, it will bring New Zealand a bit more in line with, some of our, major trading partners, in particular the UK, and show a bit more consistency. So, I do hope that you can get there, Duncan.
Yeah, look, you're right, absolutely right. That this is not a radical bill. It's actually a catch-up bill.
Yep.
And large parts of it are what in the game you call stewardship. It's just keeping the house tidy and bringing all those disparate old pieces of legislation together and modernising them. So I'm really hopeful that, across the house, the bits that they want tidied up, they'll look to the Select Committee and other processes to do that. And we'll get on it and make insurance law better. Because as you say, insurance is so central to so many people's lives. Make it better for everyone.
Well, it is. And I mean, we're a country that is constantly reminded of the importance of insurance. I mean, particularly with climate change, most New Zealanders, their main investment that they'll have is their home. And being able to insure that is just critical. Having these things are important.
Yeah, and there's longer and bigger conversations about insurance in marginal communities, communities which are subject to climate change and inundation and what have you, probably a bit beyond the scope of this bill and this conversation, but that's one we need to have as well.
Yeah, and of course there's changes across the board in terms of our health system. I'm not making this as a political statement, but there is certain aspects of our health system that are very much under strain. If not at breaking point. So people are considering, during a cost of living crisis, the issue of health insurance. That's an important part. And then, of course, just protecting income protection and belongings, car,
kids, all of these things. I'll make a political statement. Yeah. Certainly, what a health system and a social security system, that means that ordinary punter in the street doesn't feel the need to have comprehensive, health and income protection insurance. I'd much rather have a much better safety net from the state. But certainly I can entirely understand the concerns of people that they need those services. And certainly to maintain a lifestyle, those things may well be necessary in some cases.
Yeah, well, you and I are at least in the same vintage that we went through high schools. We're still talking about forms. And when you mentioned, leaving Form 7, just for those of the younger generation, that's year 13, financial literacy isn't really taught in our education system. I'm sure there are exceptions. But from what I do understand, teaching financial literacy, a key part of that is insurance, and that is making sure that you protect, your assets and your income in a certain way, because, certain events can ruin people financially if they're underinsured or non-insured at all. So this does play an important part in the average New Zealander's lives, is making sure we have a good regulatory system around insurance.
Yeah, you're right. And absolutely, I think we do need, and I know there's work done, the Retirement Commissioner does work with, Sorted, and there's an app called Banker that's in a lot of schools, I think, that does great work. We do need to teach people about how finances work, and insurance is an important part of that. And particularly, I think you alluded to kind of catastrophic events. Losing your bike's one thing, but losing your house is entirely another.
Oh, look, absolutely. And look, you might be able to help me out here. I was trying to find the stats, but I seem to recall, going back to the Christchurch earthquakes, someone actually said to me that the amount of insurance payouts, so this is money flowing to insureds, represented something like, I think it was like 1.3% of the global payouts that were paid across the globe, the planet. But the insurance premium take was something like 0.04%. So there was a massive inflow of money into Christchurch because of that. Does that kind of accord with your understanding of?
It was enormous. I forget the exact number. It was something because, of course, you had EQC, which was billions of dollars, and then insurance was a magnitude greater than that. And then, of course, on top of that, there was government money for state assets that were rebuilt. The amount of money coming in largely through insurance was absolutely enormous. And the commercial insurance as well was just phenomenal.
And look, I mean, it was a tragedy, and I don't want to downplay it at all, but to the extent that there is some sort of silver lining, I've been in Christchurch recently within the last month or so, and I love visiting Christchurch, is you can really see, you know, some great development that's gone on and making Christchurch a better city to visit and to
be.
Yeah.
And, you know, so thanks for giving me the opportunity as Christchurch Central MP to say, get down here, come and have a look at the Avon River and the work that's gone on around it, the Cashel Mall, the Transitional Cathedral, the new convention centre. I could go on and on.
Yeah.
On top of the Arts Centre, which is looking amazing as well. And a lot of that's come out of, good insurance, but in a lot of cases, of course, there's been a few top-ups. If anyone's got a spare $100 million kicking around, I know the Christchurch Cathedral would appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. We see that a lot on national TV and such good. And look, I don't want to go from the cathedral to the law courts, but I'll just say that it's fantastic to be able to spend time in the Christchurch law courts in terms of a public facility and resource. I just and I wouldn't wish there to be an earthquake in West Auckland, but the Waitakere Courthouse is in desperate need of some funding. If you're ever in a position to make that happen.
Well, the funny thing is, as on the Justice Select Committee, we had the Secretary for Justice in, and one of the things we were asking about was, what's going on with their property portfolio, and I'm pretty sure that court, along with a number of others, cropped up as, essentially priority one, because there's spaces that are effectively not usable due to dilapidation and what have you. Yep. We've got to work on that.
We do. Hey, now look, I've digressed and taken you away from the insurance contracts bill. Thank you very much for joining me on the Law Down Under podcast, Duncan Webb. It's been an absolute pleasure, and we are going to watch the progress of that bill very carefully.
So good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. Thank you for tuning in and listening to this episode of the Law Down Under podcast. You are welcome to join in on the discussion via my podcast page, which you can access at patterson.co.nz. That's patterson.co.nz. Thanks for supporting the podcast, and tune in again for more on the law, its application, and the future of the law here down under.